Hello and welcome to the Open Labour podcast. I'm joined as always by my co-host Tom Hinchcliffe. Good morning, Tom. Long time no speak. How are you doing?
Morning. Yes, it's a long time, isn't it? I mean, it's been very busy. Party conference, which we're going to talk about in a sec. But yeah, it's been a month again, so we really need to keep doing these quite quickly.
Oh, I mean, there's so much has happened. I mean, we could do a podcast for about 3 or 4 hours, actually. But as you said before, yeah, exactly. Before we logged on, you said nobody wants to speak to us for an hour, never mind 3 or 4 hours. So we'll keep it nice and short and stick to mainly issues around the Labour Party conference, which is the most pertinent, I suppose, of events at the moment. And I'm also joined today as well by Abby Baranski, Open Labour member. Abby, you're on the National Executive Committee, aren't you, of Open Labour?
Yeah, is that right? I'm the National Secretary.
Ah, brilliant. So keeping busy then doing that?
Oh yeah, definitely. Never a dull moment.
I'm sure. Okay, so as we said, we're going to keep it brief and nice and condensed. So we'll jump straight to it. Tom, what are we going to talk about first?
Keir's speech. Keir's first speech in front of a full conference before he came, after he's become leader. And I think he had a bit of a spring in his step. I mean, he did for the whole conference. I saw him a couple of times. He went to the Yorkshire reception, obviously. I was there. Something I can't miss. And, he seemed to be quite confident. I don't know if it was just because there were, you know, members there for the first time. And last year's conference was a bit of a dud because it was online and everything was focused around the pandemic. But I think he had a chance to, you know, set out his vision for the first time. I think... The change in the rules, which we'll come on to later on, I think that helped. And I think he actually had a chance to set out, you know, somewhat a vision. There were policy announcements for the first time on mental health and education mainly. But he put forward I would pay for them, which I think is important. But yeah, I think overall it was really positive. We'll come on to the hecklers in a bit, but I'd just say first that I think they strengthened his point when he's coming through and talking about Labour being ready for government and preparing us for government. I think, and he said they were shouting slogans and he's trying to change lives. I think that was the best way he could have handled it, to be honest. And I think in the media and in the kind of people that rejected Labour at the last election, that will come across quite well.
I agree. I can't help but thinking, though, if the same sort of heckling was going on when Jeremy Corbyn was leader, how the media would have spun that. I mean, don't get me wrong, it did come across well. You know, I've spoken on this podcast many a time about my views on Keir Starmer. He's not necessarily got the same politics as me, but at the end of the day, working in social care, seeing how people are suffering on the front line, being a counsellor and the amount of people that contact me that literally don't have anywhere to live, it's unbelievable. Anyway, the point that I'm getting at is we have to have a Labour government. The longer this goes on, the worse it's going to get. We've got the climate emergency as well that the Tories aren't taking seriously and just pay lip service to. We must win power. It is the most important thing. And I was willing Keir on. It was a make or break moment for him, I think. I don't know what you think, Abby.
Yeah, I'd agree with quite a bit of that, especially the bit on the hecklers making him stronger. Like, I think he made a comment, oh, it's normally the Tories heckling me at this time on a Wednesday, so carry on. Yeah. But I thought he did quite well with it and it almost empowered him. It was good, like you said, to hear about mental health. That was quite heartening as a mental health campaigner to... You know, because a lot of times the discourse around mental health services is just, oh, speak out, you know, it's important to speak out, which, yeah, it is. But there is a fundamental problem with the services and it was nice to hear that acknowledged, albeit not as detailed as I was like, but yeah, acknowledged. I did, as a woman, you know, that was the day after the Wayne Cousins trial, you know, the murder of Sarah Everard. Yeah. It was a little bit, you know, not great to hear all this stuff about putting police on the streets, because it's quite a scary time for us at the moment as women. Like, we can't trust the police. But I know that is something that will cut through with a lot of people in the public. So I don't know. It did feel to me a lot like his speech, and it was a good speech, definitely. It was very forward-facing. It was aimed at the public. It wasn't aimed at the Labour members. And I think there are bits of it that have cut through to the media, which is good, which is important, and I think it's what he was aiming to do. I think he came across, a lot of people say he does come across quite robotic, I would be one of those critics. But I definitely think this was a good moment for him in shedding that robotic image, because especially when he was talking about his mum and he was talking about the people whose daughter was sadly killed by domestic violence, he came across really emotional and really, you know, genuine. And I think that's important. I think that's one of the first times. So I thought that was good.
Mm, yeah, I think he yeah. definitely had a point to prove, especially about his background. I know he touched on that on the life stories thing on Piers Morgan, but yeah.
Yeah, but that didn't cut through in the same way. This was his big moment. I mean, just to go back to my point, though, what I was saying is I was willing him on because I do think it was a make or break moment for him. So to go back to that point, do you think it was? If Keir had flopped on this speech, were his days numbered? And how would that impact as well on the prospects of delivering a Labour government at the next election?
I think, yeah, it probably was make or break. I know that the media love to bill things as make or break all the time, but I think this genuinely was because, you know, the polls weren't going that well. Johnson was cruising, even though the mishandling of the pandemic and everything else and fuel shortages, we really needed to be making some progress. And I think it probably was a make or break moment in the end. Thankfully, Keir's speech is polled better than Johnson's, which is why it was important that he did speak to the country, as Abby touched on, rather than speaking to members. But I definitely take your point about the involvement of the police. I imagine the speech was already so ready in advance. This isn't making excuses, but I imagine that the speech was already so prepared.
No, yeah, I agree with you.
But yeah, I understand what you mean. And especially just on the mental health point, I think a few years ago, probably even 2 or 3 years ago before the pandemic, people still didn't take mental health seriously. And I think because of the pandemic, and because so many people are seeking treatment because of lockdowns and because of losing people to COVID and the whole raft of issues that have come with the pandemic, I think more people, because they need the treatment or know people that need treatment themselves, are taking it far more seriously. And to have a bit of detail, albeit not complete detail, as Abby said, but a bit of detail on, you know, the plans, it'd be like a radical expansion of the mental health workforce. So you guarantee that someone will be seen for at least an initial assessment within a month. That sometimes that can take up to a year, even for just the assessment, and unless you go private, which obviously no one can afford. So yeah, I think that might resonate a bit better than it would have done a few years ago. And that's why it got taken out. I think people like Rosina Allen Khan and things like that have helped spur that along.
Well, I agree. Yeah. And you know what? It's a good policy because my experience of the electorate is that when it comes to cuts to services, you know, what the electorate tend to talk about is perhaps police because, you know, that affects lives, but, you know, maybe police, but certainly potholes and highways department, because actually that they're the only sort of services that a lot of people come into contact with. So, you know, the fact that there's been huge cuts to adult social services, children's social services, schools, the NHS, most people aren't coming into contact with those services on a day-to-day basis. But actually mental health, it is something, as you say, the prevalence of mental health disorders has gone up, you know, extraordinarily. That doesn't make sense. Extraordinarily. What am I trying to say there?
There is a word.
What am I trying to say?
There is a word.
Yeah, something like that. You can tell it's early in the morning. Probably exponentially. Anyway, the point is the prevalence is in the increase and people are seeking treatment and there just aren't any services there. I mean, people are absolutely flabbergasted and I get contacted all the time by people when they say, well, you know, there's a waiting list of a year to, you know, before they can, that's even if they get admitted to a mental health service. You know,
I could gladly other do frontline services. Or the podcast, maybe a series rather than just an episode talking about the failures of the mental health service. But yeah, the biggest problem is that you can't even get on the list to access a service. You can't even access a service because I think most people, especially during the pandemic, I mean, Tom touched on this and was quite right, like people have had an overwhelming amount of pressure in the last year, and I think a lot of people just want someone to talk to, but you can't get that because you have to go through 5 different assessments, meds assessments first, you're getting put on lists, and it's just, you know, it adds to the pressure because now you're waiting for this service you should be able to access easily. I mean, I'm a bit radical on this. I personally push for a 2-week commitment, and I know Keir said a month, but 1 month is better than, I think it was 9 months I waited last time. So wow. I'll definitely take that as a starting point.
Yeah, I mean, all these things are there to be
built on. I don't think it's radical. Ooh. I don't think it's radical to say 2 weeks at all.
Well, I mean, a lot of people especially know what it's like. Me, everybody knows what it's like to have these problems every now and again. And obviously, some are more severe than others. But if you actually get to the point of taking the step to seek treatment for mental health, which is difficult enough, and then you're told that it's going to be 9 months or even a month, you know, I mean, a month's a good starting point, as you say. But obviously, we should be aiming, you know, for a week, 2 weeks, because, even for an initial assessment, because these things can be urgent. You know, anything can happen in that 4-week gap.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but yeah, we'll move on from that. So next, I'd like to talk about the rule changes. So let's go with the easy one first. The EHRC, implementation of the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, recommendations on
It passed by 73%, didn't it?
Yeah,
it passed 73% this one. So it was
something like that. Yeah, it was good.
Although Momentum lobbied to vote it down, didn't they? I read. Well, I wasn't there. I wasn't at the conference.
But, you know, I saw Louise Elman at the Labour Friends of Israel reception the day after, and it was great just to see her, to be honest, after these recommendations were passed, just speaking at a Labour event again. It felt like we'd, even though there's still work to do, as Jewish comrades have said before, and I'll leave it to them to judge whether there's still work to do or not. But, you know, we've overcome a huge obstacle. And I think it's one of the darkest moments in our recent history. And I think Louise coming back doesn't signal the end of it, obviously. But it does signal, you know, a formalisation of kind of, we're near the end or we're past the worst of it. And I think passing these recommendations so convincingly, it was 73-26%. I think it added to I don't know about you, Abby, but there was a less toxic atmosphere around conference. I don't know if you think, because
this was my first conference, so I can't really compare it to anything, but yeah, it definitely, I think it's so important that we pass those recommendations, and I'm proud that we did, and again, so overwhelmingly. And I think Louise Elman not only being welcomed back and not only being given a shout out during Keir's speech, but she got a standing ovation from what I remember, and that is so important to healing our relationship with the Jewish community. I think it shows that, you know, the steps that are being taken are working. So many Labour members want to heal relations with the Jewish community, want to do better. And I think, you know, I'm glad there's that goodwill, and I'm glad that we're wanting to work to do that. It's an important step. It feels like we've turned a corner as a party. Like you said, there's a way to go, but we've turned a corner. We're on our way there.
Mm.
What exactly were they? It was something about independent process, wasn't it? But also there's some stricter rules around what qualifies, isn't it, as discrimination or as anti-Semitism?
Yeah, it was changes for a new complaints system, a new complaints process to be set up. So it'll apply to all complaints about protected characteristics. So there's a lot more protection for Jewish members. And there's a lot more power for the NEC to suspend members who take part in prescribed actions and anti-Semitic tropes and things like that. And it's made things easier to formally recognise, even though we recognise a lot of the anti-Semitism ourselves before. It gives the NEC power to kind of act on that. I think Jewish Labour Movement wrote to Momentum. Earlier this week, I think it was, or the end of last week, asking why they instructed their delegates or their supporting delegates to vote against these recommendations. And Mike Katz, who's been on this podcast with me before, he signed the letter. And, you know, aside from our moral duties to kind of bookend this period, if we're ever going to be a serious party of government again, we can't be racists. It's as simple as that. And, you know, if we're ever going to bookend this period with a lot more to do, Momentum, aside from the moral side of things, we're putting the party into legal disrepute. You know, we've seen the financial impact of the anti-Semitism cases now with staff cuts at Labour HQ in Southside and things like that. You know, these things cost millions and millions of pounds in lawsuits, and so they should, because we were on the wrong side of them. But why did they vote it down?
I mean, it blows my mind. I mean, what's the point in being Labour if you're not anti-racist?
I think it was more that there were like specific, from my understanding, and I haven't looked into this very thoroughly, I think it was there were specific parts of it that they disagreed with, so they wanted to vote the whole thing down. But
did they not table an amendment then?
Yeah, I think there was not an amendment. I don't know. There was definitely something tabled because I was a delegate that was about giving conference power to reinstate the whip to people, which I think was kind of the solution to that, but I don't know. But my view is always with equality stuff, if there's a few bits you don't like vote the whole thing through and work on it later. It's important that we get the ball rolling and hash out the iron out any kinks in it later.
Yeah, exactly, because the whip, I mean, we all know who they're talking about Jeremy Corbyn, and the whip, giving this thing back to one guy does not, whoever he is not the same as dealing with racism and anti-Semitism for individual members whose lives have been ruined because of this.
Yeah, and I think it was Deeba Saeed, who is wonderful on women's rights, made the excellent point at the time when this was called for that, yeah, okay, it's being done to reinstate Jeremy Corbyn. Regardless of what you think on that, it sets a really terrifying precedent where, like, say, victims of sexual harassment are going to have to come and disclose to conference so that their accuser doesn't get the whip, so that their abuser, sorry, doesn't get the whip back. Mm. And it is a very scary precedent to set for a lot of things.
Yeah.
And we've seen how easy that is in Parliament as well, because the Rob Roberts thing.
Exactly.
He got suspended.
Politics is a scary place for women.
Yeah, of course. And it's unbelievable. Yeah. And we hear this time and time again, and nothing's done about it. I mean, Rob Roberts got suspended for a matter of weeks. I think it was like 6 weeks. And then he got to hire his own parliamentary assistant again without any oversight from Parliament or other MPs' offices, even though his previous assistant left because of sexual harassment. And it's unbelievable. But with the momentum thing, just coming back to that, I think it puts them at odds. Voting against the whole thing, as Abby said, is ridiculous because it puts them at odds with its own statement about being committed to tackling anti-Semitism. Mm. If you're voting the whole thing down, Abby's right, you should vote the whole thing through and then work on it later, because protecting Jewish members or whoever you're trying to protect, the well-being of people, is so much more important than giving the whip back to Jeremy Corbyn.
When it comes to equality issues like this, obviously. Yeah, I agree. So, a little bit more controversial then, the rule changes to reselecting MPs and thresholds for choosing the leader. It's been deemed as a success, hasn't it, on the part of Keir and the new leadership team, that they're able to get these rules through. I suppose they are. It is from their perspective. However, it didn't go as far, these rule changes, as Keir wanted to go when he initially, well, in the immediate run-up to conference. Initially, the rule changes that he wanted were around reverting back to the old electoral college system, weren't they? So, you know, this is a little bit watered down, but still really, really significant, actually, aren't they? Really significant for how the Labour Party selects its leader and for MPs facing potential trigger ballots and things for their reselections going forward.
Open Labour put out a statement in the run-up, you know, when we were hearing all these rumours of rule changes, saying that we were against the return to the Electoral College. And I think it's fair to say we don't really like the increased threshold either. Like, our whole thing as an organisation is member democracy. It is about empowering grassroots members and trying to not necessarily rid politics, but cut down the amount of these, like, backroom deals in politics that leaves ordinary people, ordinary members, cut off from the political processes. And in my view, maybe this isn't the view of everyone on the committee, but in my view, that's what this leadership threshold rule does, the exact opposite of what we as Open Labour want to do. It's taking the power out of members' hands and putting it into the PLP. And I understand the need for the PLP, for any leader of the party, to have the confidence of their parliamentary party. I get that, but I'm not sure this is the way to do it. And I think that, you know, the PLP should get behind the members' wishes anyway, but that's my view, I guess.
Well, I agree. I mean, my perspective has always been we support the leader of the Labour Party. I can't abide, actually, people that are so focused. They're Labour Party members, but they're actually more focused on undermining the leader of the Labour Party. It's been going on for years. It obviously happened so much under Jeremy Corbyn, but it's happening just as much now under Keir Starmer as well, that we're all members of these WhatsApp groups, you know, CLP groups, branch groups, and et cetera. And literally every notification is somebody moaning about Keir Starmer at the moment. So to go back to your point, I agree. I'm uncomfortable with these rule changes. I understand, yes, why MPs feel that the threshold should have increased to 20%. But if they're Labour Party MPs, then they should be getting behind the leader anyway, regardless of who it is, because they're Labour Party MPs. Tom, I think you're going to have a slightly different view on this, aren't you?
that is just assuming. No, I just think I agree to an extent, but I think we can't be fighting. We need to signal to the country that we're not going to fight leadership elections every 5 minutes. And I think the vast majority of the PLP in every leadership have a problem with the leader. You know, it happened under Blair. It happened eventually under Brown. Brown was probably the one that suffered least from it, actually. And, you know, we had the 17 MPs that signed a letter against Blair, but it was significant because there were much more than that daren't put their name to a letter because it was Blair and he'd won so many elections. Brown suffered, you know, to an extent that he went before it could kick up a stink. Obviously, Jeremy Corbyn got a lot of criticism from the PLP and got no confidence vote and things like that. I think, yeah, maybe it wasn't the right way to go about it, but at the same time, I think it sent an important signal to the country that we're not just going to talk about ourselves for the next however many years until another general election. But
then surely in debating rule changes instead of policy, we've said, yeah, we're going to keep talking about fighting ourselves.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I think now was the time to do it. If they were going to do this before the next election, this conference, in which we have to do rule changes at a conference, as you know, it has to be now, because in the next two conference seasons, we'll be announcing these policies that we'll be leading up to a general election campaign. So it was kind of now or never.
I take your point.
But I know what you mean. I agree with you.
The reason for it, I get the reasons for it, but it's about, you've got to take, when does morality and when does it, the sort of point of principle come into all of this? And as Abby said, it's about democracy and allowing members to have a say in the running of the Labour Party that's under threat. I mean, the reason that this was passed, let's face it, there's only one reason that Keir Starmer came with these proposals, and that is to kill off the left, or the hard left, if you like. That's the only reason. There's no other reason for it. It's as simple as that.
I don't think so. I think the important thing was to stop MPs fighting their own battles in their own constituencies.
I'm on about with the leadership threshold. It was to prevent somebody like Jeremy Corbyn ever getting onto the ballot for the leadership for a leadership election. That's why it's at 20%.
I'm not sure. I mean, 20%, you know, originally it was going to be 25%, that got watered down. But do we think somebody from the left or the perceived left of the party could get 20% of MPs to put them on the ballot? I think so. I don't think it's impossible. I
mean, you're an optimist.
I mean, at the moment, there's so few MPs, you know, maybe, but I think it's killed off any chance of somebody significantly to the left ever becoming Labour Party leader again. And call me a cynic, but I think that's what it was all about. The trigger ballot stuff's more interesting. I mean, it's annoying as a councillor that I have to go to a reselection every time I'm up for election, and it's just a simple majority needed to deselect you. I mean, it's very easy to deselect a councillor.
MPs have just been deselected in Manchester last night.
Oh dear.
Did they? Were they?
Yeah.
And you know, these things are often, you often get really hard-working councillors that have been doing a fantastic job, but you know, the politics might be somewhat different from some of the members, or I don't know, or there might be a bit of animosity there and some history, they've annoyed somebody, you know, all these sort of things, and then suddenly they're ousted. And councillors could be leader of the council, they could be a cabinet member and doing a good job and have a big influence in the running of a city or of their district council, and then suddenly like that they're out. Whereas MPs now, the threshold is, so let's be clear about the rule changes. It's about the threshold for the trigger ballot. It was a third of either branches, affiliated groups or unions, wasn't it? If they reached a third of any, either of those three groupings voted for a trigger ballot, then they would be a trigger ballot. Of course, then it's a simple majority. Now it has to be a third of all three of those groups put together, doesn't it? Which makes it very, very difficult to deselect an MP, basically.
I mean, again, I don't think it makes it that difficult, but it makes it more difficult. But at the same time, a lot of the MPs, and so maybe it should be the same for councillors, you know. It's difficult because a lot of MPs that did get threatened with trigger ballots and deselection had to fight battles in their own CLPs before they went to the country and their electorate in their constituency. And a lot of them lost their seats. I'm not saying that's why. But what message does that send out? Just before you're about to fight an election, I'm going to scrap my own party. And it just makes things. And these MPs are very hardworking MPs, and they're just basically at ransom to their own CLP's whims. And CLPs are very small groups of people in some cases, and they can change the whole complexion of who represents the electorate and to the country. And I just think, yeah, I think it should be more difficult for hardworking MPs to be deselected so easily. And if they are that bad, they will get this new third of affiliates as well, and they will deselect them or send them to a trigger ballot, and they'll win the trigger ballot. But it said a lot for me when a lot of MPs, no one really got deselected, and that's because this small group got their third and then lost the trigger ballot. So that just says a lot that the trigger ballot's not worth doing, is it? If you're just going to lose anyway and they still command the simple majority of their CLPs.
I take your point. I think personally I'm in two minds about this. So on the one hand, like, of course, I think it's important that we choose who represents us. And like James said, we do it at a council level. And especially when, like, a lot of the arguments in the lead up to the leadership threshold rule change that I saw for giving more power to the PLP was, oh, the PLP represent members, you know, they're Labour MPs, they represent members. Well, in some cases, they don't. So how can you make that argument and then make it harder for people to, you know, pick their own MP? So I really get that argument. On the other hand, I know this is so open Labour of me being both sides. On the other hand, I live in Manchester, which is very close to Lee. And we had Jo Platt in Lee, who was absolutely brilliant. She spent a lot of time fighting a trigger ballot when she should have been fighting for her marginal seat in the lead up to 2019. And unfortunately, we did lose in Lee. Jo Platt lost her seat. You can't say for definite, had she spent that time fighting on the doorstep instead of a trigger ballot, she would have won, but it wouldn't have done any harm, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I get it from both sides.
Me too.
Very on the
fence. I think that's why we're all at Open Labour, because I don't have a position on these. I was sort of playing devil's advocate and citing the example of councillors. Now it is different from MPs. I mean, MPs get loads more privileges. I mean, obviously they get paid a lot more than councillors, which is fair enough to a certain extent. But
this is where we get the, you know, friends of councillors.
Yeah, but did you know that if a councillor can go to prison for anything up to 3 months, anything after 3 months, then they automatically lose their seat. MPs, it's a year, I think, or 9 months or something like that. So they can go to prison. They can be in prison for a year. But as long as it's under a year, then they keep the seat, whereas it's 3 months for a councillor. It doesn't make any sense. Surely the threshold or the sort of standard that we hold MPs to should be higher than councillors to a certain extent. So there's loads of things like that. This is the same as well.
The councillor's first recall?
No. I don't know.
If an MP is arrested or charged with anything, they can then face a recall. So maybe that's the that's the worst part.
But then I guess councillors are always a year or two from I don't know how long terms are in wherever you're from.
4 years. Councillors, 4 years.
All right, councillors maximum 4 years away from being deselected anyway. Oh, that is quite a long time actually.
Yeah, you can have a rubbish council. And don't get me wrong, there's plenty of rubbish councillors out there. And to be honest, they're the ones that tend not to get deselected. They keep on going for years and years and years, and they're part of the fixtures and fittings of councils. I've seen it in all different local authorities. I'm just moaning as a councillor there, but actually the proposals, I totally get what you're both saying. And again, that's why I'm probably Open Labour. But I do see this from both sides. I can see the virtue of the new rule changes.
Abby, the Open Labour rally. at party conference, how was it? What is the future? Was it well attended? Tell us about it.
Okay, so the Open Labour rally, we immediately followed Labour for a New Democracy. He did a great pro PR rally. Ran over a bit, which meant then ours ran over a bit, but does anyone really expect any left-wing events to run on time? At this point, I would say no. So yeah, it was a really great rally, in my opinion. We had some absolutely excellent speakers. The church hall was basically full, especially at the start. Obviously, with it running over a bit, some people did leave before the end. That's to be expected. There's so many good events at conference. Everyone wants to go to them all. We had David Lammy, who was absolutely brilliant. So many other really brilliant speakers. Alex, I know we're all fans of Alex. He did actually, in my opinion, kind of steal the show a bit because he made some really excellent points on trans rights that I don't think any other MP has been making about how we need to go beyond just saying trans rights are human rights. We need to move past that and actually make life easy for trans people, which was great to hear. And obviously that's a stance we completely take in Open Labour. It was, I think it was a good rally. Jermaine Jackman was brilliant as well. There was a lot of honesty about the party's failings and talking about where we can go next. And I think that's important. And I think when there's been a lot of discussion about how, you know, online about what's Open Labour's niche, where do Open Labour stand? I think it's good and it's important that we've said, look, these are what we see as the problem. This is how we're going to push forward. And I think it's very heartening how many people, how many of our speakers, Jermaine, Alex, David Lammy, noted that the biggest issues in our party are equality issues. It's very heartening. You know, I always think that I'm in Open Labour because it's one of the only factions that's completely unequivocal when it comes to minority communities, and that really reinforced that. So I was very pleased, and we got loads of new members from it, which was brilliant. We actually had a problem with our website, which was quite unfortunate, but we have paper membership forms. Alex is prepared. So loads of renewed interest in the organisation. We got loads of new members, loads of renewed interest. Actually, a lot of people have approached me about starting regional groups where they're from, which is absolutely brilliant. I know you guys are West Yorkshire. You've just had your AGM, but a lot of interest in starting groups in the South and stuff as well. So that's good. It's overall, I think it's very positive for the organisation. I'm very proud.
Good. Yeah, I saw Alex's speech, I suppose. And yeah, I was so impressed with what he was saying about trans rights. It was, he did us proud really on that issue. So good for him. I didn't really see the rest. I wish I'd seen Jermaine. We've had Jermaine on here, and we supported his candidacy for the NEC way back when. And he's a lovely guy and really good and a talent as well. He's definitely talented, and hopefully we'll see a lot more of him in the future. I'm sure he'll get a seat somewhere. I mean, let's face it, there's plenty of seats to fight for. There's only, 200 of us, isn't there? So there's plenty of seats.
Yeah, one day
there.
When Jermaine's an MP, I'm gonna brag like, oh yeah, I ran his campaign for the NEC back in 2020.
Don't tell anyone he lost.
No. Look, I got 2 out of 4. I don't think it's that bad.
That's fine.
You did very well, Abby.
Thank you.
It's been brilliant to have you on. I mean, we've got to go because we've all got busy schedules, but it's been really great. You're going to have to come on more often, Abby. It's really enjoyed.
It's been really brilliant to talk to you. I've loved coming on.
I think we're a bit rusty though, Tom, aren't we? We're normally a little bit slicker than this. I think it's because it's been a month or two, hasn't it?
Speak for yourself. I think I'm on it.